Matthew chapter 22 and verse 37. This, as you probably are already thinking, is the place where Jesus Christ said the greatest commandment is and the second greatest commandment is. All of God's commandments hang on each other in an organized fashion. Years ago I did a chart, which I can't find, but I plan on redoing it at some point whenever I get a little bit better at doing PowerPoint. To organize or kind of show the organization of how God's law is made for us in the Bible. God says that He is love. If you kind of look at a pyramid, a flat pyramid, not a three-dimensional, but a flat pyramid, the very top of it would be love, because God is love. Then the two great commandments that show us how to love are, number one, the command to love our Father, love God, our God with all of our heart, all of our mind, all of our spirit, all of our soul. That's the first great commandment, and the second commandment next to it would be to love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, in Matthew chapter 22, verse 36, a lawyer asked him a question saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment of the law?" He said to them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. And this is the first and great commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So under these two commandments, then, are organized the other commandments and the other laws. So on one side, you would have what the Jews call the two halves of the Ten Commandment tablets. On the first tablet, there are five commandments that describe how to love God, how to keep that first commandment. They group in the commandment to honor your father and mother in the side of how to honor God, because they feel that honoring our physical parents in the right way is a way of honoring God. Then the second tablet of those Ten Commandments is the five commandments that begin with not murdering and, of course, not all the things we're not supposed to do in dealing with our fellow man. Now then below those commandments, there are more specific commandments that are called statutes. Statutes are laws. They are statutes. They are commandments of God, but they are not the Ten Commandments. They are simply more defined ways of obeying the Ten Commandments and the great commandment and then the greatest commandment, which is love, God Himself, becoming like God Himself. Now the statutes, if we line them out, concern a number of things. Keeping the holy days would be a statute. It goes under the Sabbath commandment. There are other statutes that we could talk about that are fairly straightforward as to which commandment they are under. It's kind of an interesting quiz to go through the statutes and figure out which commandment is attached to which statute. Then under the statutes, and I believe you're getting up into the 60 to 80 number range, there are judgments. The judgments are how do you apply certain laws or statutes to a given everyday situation. So the statutes would include things like if your neighbor's cow runs over your fence and does some damage on your property, how much restitution is needed. And there are a number of judgments in the Bible that are pretty clear, and it's pretty simple to see which commandment or which statute they would then hang under, because they all kind of hang under that and, of course, form this pyramidal structure of God's law. Today I want to talk about one of the statutes that is part of the first commandment, the commandment that God gave us to love Him first. Let's go over to Exodus chapter 20, where He says, "We are to have no other gods before Him." Exodus chapter 20 and verse 1. This is the very first commandment of the ten. It's part of the great commandment to love God with all of our heart, all of our soul, and all of our being, and Him only serve. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 1, God spoke all these words and said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. I'm the God that freed you from slavery in that foreign land." It says, "You shall have no other gods before me." Very simple. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, one of the most important statutes that we have below this that hangs on this commandment is the statute of tithing. Because where we put our 10%, where we give our offering of 10%, whether we give it to God and show that it's His money, we give it to Him to identify Him as our God, or we give it to ourselves, identify ourselves as our God, it's very important. Let's go back to Mark chapter 12. Jesus Christ said very plainly, we must render to God the things that belong to Him. And this, of course, is dealing with finances. But tithing is a very important statute of God. It's one that we find Abraham, Jacob, and others obeying, and one that many people today, of course, try to avoid. I went on several of the typical Bible study internet sites in preparation for this, one of the Bible.org and some of the others. And if you look up writings and sermons that have been given by various Protestant ministers around the country on tithing, they are so afraid to say it's a law of God that applies to us today. They kind of dance around it and say it would be a good idea and it's a good principle to follow and, you know, that's how God wanted things back then, but now, of course, they teach the law is all done away. But it's so interesting how they sort of dance around it and deny that there is New Testament evidence for tithing that, of course, is very strong. In Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 13, we have the Pharisees and some of the Herodians, some of the servants in the household of King Herod. They decide they're going to play the gotcha game. Now, the gotcha game, we're all familiar with that. They do it on television from time to time. They have guests on TV, and then the interviewers have this sort of plan to lead them up to a certain bunch of questions and finally spring the gotcha on them. For some of us old types, we recall probably the most famous gotcha program in history, which was called 60 Minutes. Remember the 60 Minutes program? Mike Wallace or somebody would try to have a guest on there who would then lead all these questions, and then they had this evidence they would spring on them at the last minute and play the gotcha game. So here we have the Pharisees and Herodians trying to play gotcha with Jesus Christ. Verse 14, when they had come, they said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true." So they begin to, you know, sort of flatter him and butter him up. "Oh, we know you are true. We know you have high character. You care not about anyone. You don't accept bribes. You don't prefer people. You do not regard the person of men. You're not in awe of high status and office. But you teach the way of God in truth." So here they had all these, you know, questions. In their mind, their strategy was to disable his defenses, make him kind of follow their line of reasoning down to where they wanted him to give an answer. Then they launched the gotcha question. "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" So here they hope to catch him. They hope to catch him in some question he couldn't answer or would answer wrong, and then they would have something to accuse him of. He said, "Why do you test me? Bring me a denarius, which is a Roman coin, that I may see it." So they brought it. He said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" And this was only a few years after the Roman emperors began having their picture inscribed on the coins. It was started, I think, by Augustus. This, of course, would have been during the time of Tiberius. But they did have Roman coins that had stamped on them the impression of the face of the emperor. So he said, "Bring me a denarius that I may see it." They brought it. He said to them, "Well, whose image and inscription is this?" And it would have said Tiberius, and it would have said, you know, Tiberius Maximus emperor, you know, he began to reign, I think he began to reign in 22 AD. So they would have said, you know, what might have said, what year would a 22 AD been before there was a 22 AD, whatever. It may have been the Romans, I think, counted from the founding of the Republic was how they counted time. Anybody knowing that? I think so. So it would have been Annus Dio, something like 485 or something like that. So at any rate, it would have had a date on there of when Tiberius became emperor and Tiberius's face, or side view of his face. So they said to him, "Well, that's Caesar's." Jesus answered and said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And he's talking about money. He didn't say, well, God doesn't want any money. Tithing's done away. Offerings are done away. We're replacing tithing with begging. No, it's not what it is. Or in some churches, they've replaced tithing with tipping. So they pass this plate, and you know, you put in a tip. That, of course, doesn't please God and doesn't provide for God's work, and certainly is not something that God promises to bless. So that God says we are to render to him the things that are his. Now, the truth of the matter is everything is his. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 14. Deuteronomy chapter 10, we'll begin in verse 12. We have to realize that God owns everything, that he is the creator of everything, he's the owner of everything, that all that we have comes from him. Nothing comes from ourselves. We haven't created any wealth by ourselves. Deuteronomy chapter 10, begin in verse 12. "Now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your souls. This really is the great commandment that Jesus Christ quoted. Notice, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes. So you show you love God by keeping the Ten Commandments and then the statutes that are simply more specific ways of applying those commandments, which I command you today for your good. Indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God, also the earth with all that it is. So God owns everything. He is the God who believes everything. He owns everything. He created everything. There's nothing except what he created. The Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them. He chose their descendants after them as you are peoples, above all people as it is this day. So God gave them this land and he gave them the promise, but he says everything belongs to God. Nothing that is of value does not belong to him. Let's also go over to Exodus chapter 19 and verse 5. Let's go back to Exodus. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 5. Before the Ten Commandments were given, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for the earth is mine. Everything in the earth is mine. Nothing is not God's. Now, God is the God who has the ability to give us wealth, prosperity, to give us everything that is of any real value. And of course, people today don't want to acknowledge God. Let's go over to the book of Psalms, Psalm 24 and verse 1, just to prove that God has told us many times that he really is the owner of everything. So when we have assets, when we have wealth, when we have possessions given to us, we're just simply borrowing them from God. God loans them to us to see how well we will do. He was faithful in little things, is also faithful in much. Jesus Christ said that, and it is also very true. So he's testing us to see if we are going to be faithful in our little things so that he can someday make us in charge of very much. In Psalm 24 and verse 1, it says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So everything in the earth, all that it is full of, is God's. The world and those who dwell therein, he has founded the seas and established it upon the waters. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord? Who can go up to Jerusalem? Who may have stand on his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, and has not lifted up his soul to an idol, nor sworn deceitfully. He shall receive a blessing from the Lord. Now, to swear deceitfully would include swearing that God will be our God, which we do. We make a commitment with him at baptism, and then not following through with that. Let's go over to Psalm chapter 50 and verse 10. You know, we have to acknowledge that all real wealth comes from the land, either through growing crops, food, the mining of metals or of oil, of fish, wildlife, animals. But all real wealth comes from what God created. And when people buy and sell things that God created or value out of the land today, it's called commodities. And so you may be familiar with the buying and selling of commodities. And a lot of it's done in Chicago at the Board of Trade building. I've gone down there several times and watched them with all their yelling and screaming and running around, all these people buying and selling, you know, corn and wheat, whatever. The number one commodity bought and sold in the world today is oil. It comes from the ground. Now, does anyone know what the number two commodity is, dollar-wise? The second most important commodity in the world? You probably all helped out this morning, come think of it. Coffee. Yeah, coffee is the second most important commodity in the world in terms of numbers of dollars bought and sold in exchange worldwide. What's third? Anyone know what's third? No, I think it's wheat, but I'm not sure. None of the metals come anywhere close to the amount of money that's bought and sold when it comes to farm products and food, but I think it's wheat, but I might be wrong on that. But commodities are things that come out of the earth. They either are grown or they are mined, they are dug, and they are then packaged and used to sustain life. That's what real wealth is. Now, in the modern day society, we have come up with a new type of wealth called intellectual wealth, intellectual value, things like software. Then there's intellectual property rights, like the rights to write a song. You know, the goal of every songwriter is to write the next big hit and then to retire for the rest of his life, getting royalties off the radio stations that play his song. So I've never written a song like that, but some of you may have that potential. But intellectual property rights probably are not going to be of much value when you're starving. If you really are hungry, there's nothing to eat, I don't think that a CD-ROM is going to be very tasty or very good for you. And whatever music that the, or whatever sheet music that song might be printed on wouldn't be of very much value either. But real value in God's eyes comes from the land. It's the commodities, and He owns all of those. Notice verse 14 says, "I offer to thanks God, or offer to God thanksgiving. Pay your vows to the Most High." And when we made our commitment of baptism, we committed that we would honor God with the first fruits of all of our increase. We would obey that commandment of tithing. He says, "Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." So it is God's prerogative to give us His wealth to share. Let's go back to Deuteronomy now in chapter 30 and verse 19. As we approach tithing, the best approach is to understand that it really isn't our money, that God has a complete claim over the first tenth. And in fact, the other 90% God owns, He's simply loaning it to us, allowing us to use it, to see if we're going to use it to honor Him, that all things will be done to glorify Him, that we use it in an honorable and correct way, and that our balances are even and correct, and that everybody is conducting themselves in a godly manner. Deuteronomy chapter 30, let's start in verse 10. Well, actually, let's start in verse 9. "The Lord your God will make you abound in all the work of your hand." So God promises in verse 8 that if we obey Him and do His commandments, He will make us abound in the work of our hand. It doesn't mean that we're all going to win the lottery. We're not going to have Ed McMahon calling on the phone every Sunday. It's sad that in America, so many have gambled their future hoping that ill-gotten gain would be their, you know, would be their way to freedom and happiness. Now, they know they can't make or earn enough money, so they try the get-rich-quick schemes, or they send all this money and always trying to win these contests or go down and gamble it. It's sad there are more and more casinos being built every year. There's another huge one going in down somewhere on I-5 when you head south. So, you know, the gambling thing is simply a way of an ill-gotten gain, and so many of our society, the people today, have been focused on that. It's really sad. But God says He will abound the work of our hand. He will be our partner in our life work if we obey Him. He said, "In the fruit of your body, in the increase of your livestock, and the produce of your land for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good as He rejoiced over your fathers, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God, to keep His commandments and His statutes, which are written in this book of the law." So He's saying the commandments and statutes written in this book are key to our being blessed by God. If you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Verse 15, He says, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, and that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, to keep His commandments, His statutes, His judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess." But He says, if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you will surely perish, and you shall not prolong your days. The people of Israel were caught up in some of the same deception that today embroils America. You know, the sad thing is that most Americans feel their happiness is based on their physical possessions, that it is the physical things that we possess that bring people happiness. And I watched part of an Oprah show. I don't watch Oprah, but I was watching, doing something, and Oprah was on TV, and she was touring around some big new mansion she bought in California, and she kept on talking about how much she loved this room and loved this furniture and loved this painting and loved. She doesn't have any children, her husband, so she has to love all these things. But people today in America are focused on their things, thinking that things give them happiness when things do not give us happiness. Things can make life a little easier, but real happiness comes from our relationships, first with God and secondly with our spouse and family. But here we are very, you might say, challenged, because we're constantly bombarded with this message that more and more things will get you more and more happiness, which of course it doesn't. But let's go over to the real statute we are talking about. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 27. Leviticus chapter 27 and verse 30 is simply a very straightforward simple directive from God, that the tithe of all the land, of all sorts of tithe, not just as some of the gainsayers would try to convince you, well, it's only on wheat, or it's only on barley, or it's only on certain types of, you know, fruit products or farm products, you don't have to tithe anything else. They're trying to do away with tithing because they don't want to get rid of their money. They want to keep it all for themselves. And in fact, it shows that their real God is themselves, because whoever you tithe to is the God you worship. Verse 30 of Leviticus 27. All the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. So whatever grows, whatever a person produces, his increase is holy to the Lord. If a man wants to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. Now this is important because first he's talking about what grows. So when they would harvest wheat or barley, they had their little sickles and they would cut the wheat and they would stack it in round, they'd tie ropes around a kind of a big bunch of it, about a foot in diameter, and they would stack these up. They would come along with oxen pulling wagons, and they would put all these stacks of wheat on the wagons, and then take them over to the threshing floor that Mr. Berg talked about in the sermonette, and they would then beat them on the ground and then pound them and then throw some up in the air, and what's called winnowing or threshing the wheat. Well, when they tied, they simply took every tenth big shock of wheat, would be laid over to the side and then taken to the temple to the Levites as their first tithe. Now, if it was really, really good quality wheat and they wanted to use it as seed for the following year, they could then take other wheat and redeem that tithe by adding one-fifth to it. So if it weighed 100 pounds, they would add 20 pounds and make it 120. So if they had the what looks like really, really good seed off of one part of the field, they wanted to use that for next year's sowing, then they would be able to redeem the fruit produce. Now concerning the tithe of the herd of the flock, they were not able to redeem it. Any sheep or goat, any little lamb that was dedicated to God could not be redeemed. Once a lamb is dedicated to God, it is his, and that's the end of the subject. Concerning the tithe of the herd of the flock, or whatever passes under the rod. So in the springtime, the sheep all go out, the ewes go out in the pasture, and they have all their little babies. We used to watch some of that down in Oregon where the big flocks of sheep would have all their babies. And then as they were brought in then, probably about the middle of June, brought back into the stockades, they would pass under a rod through the gate and they would count them. And so they count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you're it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you're it. And every tenth little sheep that was born that year, obviously the yearlings are the newborns are easy to tell, would then be the tithe. Notice he shall not inquire whether it is good or bad. You can't say, well, is that a really good-looking little lamb or is that a bummer lamb that's about to die? You know what a bummer lamb, anyone not know what a bummer lamb is? You've heard the term, that's a bummer, right? Well, in most cases, a ewe will have twins. And you watch the sheep, the fields around Corvallis and all down Sweet Home, all that area, most all the ewes have twins. But every now and then they have triplets. And since they only have two feeding mechanisms, put that in, you know, Sabbath terminology here. Since they only have two feeding mechanisms on a sheep, normally two of the lambs are a little stronger than the third, and they keep the third from getting enough food. They protect their food supply, and the third lamb then becomes fairly weak and begins to sort of waste away. And then when he comes over to the mother will actually kick at him because sort of like some of the ewes know they only have enough milk supply to properly feed two babies. So the lambs that are rejected by their mother or unable to feed because of their siblings are called bummer lambs. And they're at Corvallis at the little auction we used to go down. We lived in Albany, and you could buy bummer lambs for $5 a piece. So we got our kids' lambs a couple of years, you know, little white and black lambs that got out of our backyard into the neighbors, ate their roses and all that sort of stuff. But a bummer lamb is one that is rejected by his parent and will probably die a natural death. And every now and then you'll die down I-5, you'll see a dead lamb laying out in the field. And that's normally what happens, is that they simply starve to death because they can't, not allowed to eat. So you can't look at your sheep that pass under the rod and say, oh, that's a bummer, we want to use that for tithe. Or, oh, that's not a bummer, that's a beautiful lamb, I want to keep him because he'll be really good eating in about a year. You can't do that. It's whatever passes under the rod. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, that's it. That's the ones that are dedicated and holy to God. It says, it shall not be redeemed. It says, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. So this is a commandment. It's not an option. The tithing rule is a commandment. Let's go over to Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 9. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 9, which tells us really that we are to honor God, that we are to honor Him with the first fruits of all of our increase. That God set up tithing to begin with as a way of identifying who our God is, and also as a way of us bringing honor to God, because we honor Him by showing that He is first, that He gets the first tenth of all that we produce, all of our increase, that we work by our labors. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 8, I'm sorry, verse 9, honor the Lord with your possessions. You know, the opposite of this is if you don't honor God, you dishonor Him. You can dishonor God with your possessions. If you give it to yourself first, then you've dishonored God. And with the first fruits of all your increase. So with the first fruits of all your increase each year, we honor God. So your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will overflow with new wine. So it's a real straightforward statement from God that we should honor Him with our possessions and with the first fruits of our increase. Now, there are a number of other statutes in the Bible that would be kind of parallel to this. And one of them would be the law of the firstborn, that when you have animals, that the first one that is born, what's called opening the matrix, is to be honored or dedicated to God. So when my little dog has puppies, I suppose, how do you find out what's the first puppy born? When you walk out in the morning and the dog's got 10 puppies, do you know which one? Okay, raise your right paw. Who's first? You don't know. So I suppose unless we're there watching, we won't know which one is born first, and we'll have to just take one of them and say, well, we assume this may have been the firstborn. But, you know, I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll take it up to Mr. Luker. You know, he's my original pastor, so I'll give him, here's my firstborn offering. It's my firstborn puppy here this year from this female, because she's a new female. The thing of it is, Mr. Luker, he wants a poodle that he can fit in this little tiny bag. You know, I've got Chesapeake Bay Retrievers, and the father of the puppies is 85 pounds. So now, do I take a Chesapeake little puppy up to Mr. Luker and say, here you go, here's your new, here's your first fruits? He might not like that. But I could put it in a box and mail it to Cincinnati. And they might not like it either, because how many have had a new puppy the first few nights after it's been taken away from its mommy? And they're not quiet, and they're not happy. So that might not be very good either. So I assume the thing to do is to simply sell it and then to take the money and send it in as an offering, and that would be fulfilling the spirit of the law, what God really wants us to do as far as, you know, honoring Him. Now, I suppose if Mr. Kylo wanted a puppy, I could offer it to him. I could call him and ask him, but he's so busy traveling around, I don't think he'd have time to raise and train a hunting dog. But let's go over to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. The important thing is that each one of us is responsible to obey God's laws, and the statute of tithing is a very important one because it shows that we are putting Him first in our life. It's a way of honoring God, loving Him with all of our heart, all of our mind, all of our being, and not having any idol before Him. It's up to each one of us as to how we do that, honestly and with integrity, because no one's going to come over to your house and go through your checkbook and say, well, you made so much money, therefore your tithe has to be this much, and here you were shorted $10. I mean, there is no such auditing system set up. I don't think there ever will be. I certainly hope there's not. But there is a God who sees everything, and whatever is done in secret, He rewards us for openly. So we have our own conscience and our own knowledge of what God wants that serves as our guide. In Joshua chapter 24, in verse 8, he says, I brought you into the land of the Amorites who dwelt on the other side of the Jordan, and they fought with you, but I gave them into your hand that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them before you. So God gave them the land. Down in verse 12, he says, I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you. And the hornets over in that part of the world are great big black things with big yellow stripes on them. I know because I've felt them. And they are about an inch and a half long, and I assume if they wanted to really get you that they really would, because they have great big stingers sticking out their back. I heard, Mr. Frankel, if they fly really, really fast, and right before they get to you, they turn around so they can drive that stinger in, and it feels like a bat hitting you. But fortunately, they just flew around us. They didn't hit any of us, so that was good. But God used hornets to drive out the enemy. Verse 13, I have given you a land for which you did not labor, and cities which you did not build, and you dwell in them. You eat of the vineyards and olive groves which you did not plant. So God brought the people of Israel across the Jordan River and then placed them in the land of promise after the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Canaanites had been expelled. So they came into land that had already been plowed. The fields were already getting ready to produce. In fact, they came in and conquered in the springtime right before the harvest of wheat and barley. That's why the manna was ceased as soon as they crossed the River Jordan, because at that time they could simply walk out of the fields and begin harvesting grain for them to eat. And there would have been some of the other fruits and foods stored in the villages that they took that they could have eaten off and sustained themselves on. But notice that God gave them a land for which they did not labor. The way it was set up was that virtually every family had an equal basis for acquiring wealth or for production. They had almost equal sizes of land according to the size of the family. A case can be made that perhaps the Ephraimites and the Danites got a little better land than the other tribes because the hill country of Ephraim to the north and east of Jerusalem and the area to the far north up around the Hula Valley and the Megiddo area where Dan was, the slopes of Mount Hermon, the approaches to Mount Hermon, was some of the most productive and beautiful land, probably a little better than what the Benjaminites got south of Jerusalem and what Judah got and some of the others, Zebulun over towards the coast. So, but overall, the tribes were fairly equal. That they got land they were very happy with, and they got land according to their families. Now, when a young man reached the majority age, if he was the firstborn, he got a double portion, but basically he got his wife and he got his land all in the same time, or pretty close to it. So he received his inheritance when he arrived at a certain age to begin his life and establishing his own family. Now, today we do it a lot different. Today we, you know what age most Americans receive their inheritance? Probably Mr. Ewing knows this, but what's the average age of receiving an inheritance when your parents die in America? I think it's 62. It may be 58, but I think it's 62. Because the average age length in America now is 76 and a half years, but that factors in all those who die early. So most people have parents like my parents who are 84 years old, and my father is still winning golf tournaments, although I think last year all he won was a couple long ball tournaments. And my mom is still doing very well, so they could live up, 90s or 100s. In fact, I don't know of any sextons who have died younger than 98 unless they were already embalmed. So they might live up, my grandpa lived to be 103. But for most of us, we can count on inheriting what our parents have acquired after we retire, or really close to our retirement age. That's just the way it is today. Now, in the system that God set up under Joshua, people received their inheritance when they were about 20 years old, 22 years old, and they got their portion of the land, they got their wife, and they could then start making a productive family together. And if they didn't do well and lost the land, it was returned to the family every 50 years. The land simply could not be sold. If they borrowed money against the land, then every land Sabbath or every 7 years, all debts were forgiven, and the land again returned to them debt-free. Now, that would be certainly different than what we have today. It'd be nice if at age 20 or 21, every young man had a nice piece of land that you could call his own. Most people turning 21, 22 today, especially if you live in an area like we do, the prospect of trying to buy land is foreboding. When little tiny beat-up houses in Seattle that were built in 1910 on a 50-foot by 100-foot lot are selling for almost $1 million, who could come up with that kind of money unless you're a Microsoft bigwig or something? But at any rate, God's system was far better. And for part of our history, we tried to establish these principles in our land. The Northwest Land Ordinance of 1787, which established the giving of by the U.S. government of all the land east of the Allegheny Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains, west through Ohio, Tennessee, Kentucky, and on out. They would allot 160 acres for a head of household and 320 to a married couple, and you could what's called homestead. You go there and live on it, fence it, put up some buildings, start raising a farm, and it was yours. Now, if we had kept that law intact and said those pieces of land could not be bought up by corporations or by foreign nationals, we'd be much better off. I think how much better off our nation would be today if all of that land back there was all still in 160-acre parcels, still in the families and the descendants of those families that originally homesteaded it. Instead, huge tracts of our productive farmland are owned by foreign nationals or foreign corporations, a lot from the Orient, China, Hong Kong, other places. So we have lost the ownership of much of our productive farmland, and individuals have lost opportunity to start life and get ahead like they had during the time of Joshua. So instead we have, you know, fewer and fewer people owning more and more of the productive land of our country. Now, God owns everything, as we mentioned. We're only giving him back what is his already. But let's go over to 1 Chronicles chapter 29. 1 Chronicles chapter 29 and verse 12. And right towards the end of 1 Chronicles. This is where King David is praying to God. He's collecting offerings for the temple, which he would not build, but he would collect offerings for it so that later his son Solomon could build it. But he says in verse 11 of 1 Chronicles 29, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power, and the glory, the victory and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head over all. Both riches and honor come from you. You reign over all. In your hand is power and might. It is in your hand to make great and to give strength." So here, David understood that everything he had came from God, and everything that was of any value belonged to God. He understood his position as being a steward or temporary custodian of what really belonged to God. Now let's look at some of the history of first tithe. Over in Genesis chapter 14 is the first account. I'm sure you are familiar with this account of Melchizedek, who came into contact, or said, I guess we should say Abraham came into contact with him. Melchizedek was priest of Salem, so he was at the same site as Jerusalem. Doesn't say exactly where he was in Jerusalem around that area, but certainly there's a good possibility would have been, you know, on Mount Moriah or somewhere near there, where Melchizedek, king of Salem, had some sort of a ministry going. Now we know from Hebrews that he was Jesus Christ, or the one who became Jesus Christ, and just simply chronologically speaking, it was about 2,000 years after the creation of Adam and Eve when Melchizedek had his ministry there in Salem or Jerusalem. It was 2,000 years before Jesus Christ came in 27 AD, and very likely 4,000 years then before Christ came again. So looking at just simply the cycles, it would look as if Christ comes to the earth for a physical ministry on schedule about every 2,000 years. And if that's the case, then we could, you know, look at Christ returning again maybe 2020, 2027, right along in there. I'm not setting dates, I'm just postulating on what might happen. And of course, we are a nonprofit organization. We all know that. Genesis chapter 14, this is when Abram heard that his brother Lot was taken captive. He divided his forces and went down to conquer the people who had captured his relative. Verse 18, he came back after God granted him a great victory. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now there is some thought that perhaps the bread and wine here are the symbols of the Passover, that Melchizedek was explaining to Abraham that someday there would be a Savior who would die for the sins of the world, and these symbols would be of him and of what his redemption work would do for mankind. Whether or not that's the case here, we really don't know. But it does say he was priest of God Most High, that God had a priesthood here on the earth at that time, and it was a Melchizedek priesthood. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." So God possesses heaven and earth. Abram worships him. "Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hands." So that's what Abram said to Melchizedek. And notice, he gave him a tithe of all of the spoil. It would not just have been produce of the farmland, but it would have been gold, silver, possessions, dishes, whatever it might have been, clothing. He gave him a tithe of all. So here we have in this account several interesting keys. Number one, the recipient of the tithe is God's representative on the earth. Melchizedek was on the earth as a priest of God, and that's whom the tithes were given to. The tithe payer was the one who had the increase. The reason for the tithing was to acknowledge God as the ultimate owner of wealth and the provider of all blessings. So as he gives him this tithe, he gives the blessing and says, "Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered these enemies into my hand." And the third important thing about this is the computational base. It was 10% of all Abraham's increase. In this case, it was the spoils of battle. Now, Abraham is the father of all those who believe in Romans chapter 4 and verse 11. Obviously, in Galatians, mentions that if we are Jesus Christ, then we are Abraham's seed and heirs according to his promise. And in Genesis 26:5, it says that Abraham obeyed God's laws, his commandments, his statutes, and his charge. The charge being the work he had for him to do, and the laws, commandments, and statutes, of course, being God's laws. So a lot in this to prove that from the very beginning, God wanted tithes being paid. This, by the way, was about 450 years before Moses on Mount Sinai received the law from God. So tithing antedated Moses by a long, long time. Let's go back over to Genesis chapter 28 now to show that his grandson Jacob also understood tithing. And Jacob, as you know, was traveling. He came to a place called Bethel, which means house of God. It's the place where the tabernacle was set up by Joshua when they first crossed over the Jordan River. If you've been to Israel, you can take a little tour out to Bethel. Right now, it's just kind of a field full of rocks and sheep, not much to it. But when Jacob awoke from this dream where he saw these angels going up and down from heaven to earth on this ladder, Jacob awoke from his dream and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it." Verse 17, he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." So Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put at his head to sleep on, and set it up on a pillar, and he poured oil on top of it. He called the name of the place Bethel, which means house of God. But the name of that city had been Luz previously, which means light. Then Jacob made a vow and said, "If God be with me," now God made me a promise, he would protect me everywhere I go. "So if God's going to do this for me and will keep me in the way that I'm going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. I will honor him and no other gods." Recall that Laban, whom he had lived with for a number of years, had idols because Rachel had been keeping idols under her clothes at one point. So he's saying, "I'm going to have no other God. The Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house," signify God's presence. "And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." So all that God gives us, we would surely give a tenth to him. So Jacob made a promise that this is how he signified, or one way he was signified, that the Lord would be his God, would be by tithing, by giving a tenth of all of his increase. And a very important vow he made, and of course God says to keep all of your vows to God, but the vow is simply to obey what God says to do. Now let's go over to Numbers chapter 18 and verse 25. Numbers 18 and verse 25. God says very plainly that he gives the tithes which belong to him to the Israelite, the Levites. The tithes are really God's, but he has given them to the Levites because in ancient Israel they had no land. Joshua divided up to them certain cities to live in, and they had very small plots where they could grow a garden, but they had no inheritance of land. They did not die and pass their land on to the next generations. So in Numbers chapter 18, let's start in verse 21. "Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting." So God gave the tithes to the children of Israel's physical servants, which would be the Levites. So it's very obvious this is the first tithe. The use of the second and third tithe is much different. "Hereafter, the children of Israel shall not come near the tabernacle of meeting, lest they bear their sin and die. But the Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle." Verse 24, "For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. Therefore I have said to them, among the children of Israel they shall have no inheritance." So the Levites received the tithe given to them from God. But notice verse 26. Thus God says to the Levites through Moses, say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithe which I have given you from them as an inheritance. So God says, look, you Levites, I am giving you the tithe as your inheritance. Then you shall offer it up as a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe. So the Levites also tithe, and they gave a tenth of what they received to the high priest, which means that Aaron, the high priest, and his descendants, their gross income for the year would be 1% of the gross national increase for that year, which would be obviously a very, very large amount of produce. They couldn't eat it all. I don't know what they did with all the rest of it, but they certainly had a very, very high level of income, or the equivalent of income, even though it would have been primarily, you know, sheep, goats, things to eat. Verse 27, and your heave offering shall be reckoned to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor and the fullness of the winepress. I told the Levites, when you receive something, you tithe on it just like it was your own threshing floor or your own winepress. Thus you shall offer a heave offering to the Lord from all your tithes which you receive on the children of Israel. You shall give the Lord's heave offering from it to Aaron the priests. Of all your gifts you shall offer up every heave offering due to the Lord from all the best of them, the consecrated part. So here we have the Levites also tithe. They also gave a tenth of what they possessed to God. It's important because later we'll read about how that tithing system was changed into whom the tithes were given to. But first let's go back to 2 Chronicles 29. As the history of Israel unfolds, men obeyed God for a generation or two, and then they disobeyed God, and they were sent into captivity or punishment, one form or another. When the true religion was restored by a proper leader, one of the first things they had to do was to restore tithing in the land so that God could then bless them. In 2 Chronicles chapter 29 and verse 1, it says, Hezekiah became king when he was 25. He reigned in Jerusalem for 29 years. Verse 2, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. In the first year of the reign, of his first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, for the temple had been closed up. Those who had followed idolatry had actually locked up the doors of the temple, and everything was in disrepair. The furniture overturned, everything dirty, full of cobwebs, whatever. He had to repair the doors of the temple. And over in chapter 31, just a couple pages over, beginning in verse 20, we find that Hezekiah set up the tithing system. In fact, he reestablished the tithing system so the Levites could then have their proper tithes and proper ways to live. 2 Chronicles chapter 31, verse 5, as soon as the commandment was circulated, the children of Israel brought in abundance the first fruits of grain and wine, oil and honey, and of all the produce of the field, they brought in abundantly the tithe of everything. And the children of Israel and Judah, who dwelt in the cities of Judah, brought the tithe of oxen and sheep. Also the tithe of holy things, which were consecrated to the Lord their God, they laid in heaps. So Hezekiah reestablished the tithing system as one of the fundamental things he had to do to get the nation back on the right land, or back on the right track. And verse 20, of course, simply says he did throughout all Judah what was good and right and true before the Lord his God. Then over in Nehemiah chapter 13, just over a couple of books to Nehemiah chapter 13, much, much later in Israel's history, a time when the temple had been somewhat rebuilt, years had gone by, Nehemiah had heard about the lax religion of the people. They had become very lax in keeping God's Sabbath and keeping God's laws. The interracial, or not interracial, but marrying of the non-Israelites, those who were worshiping idols in the land around them, the Jebusites, and of course, even worse than that, the Samaritans who had been brought in from Babylon and had sun worship with them. And all of that had to be put away. But in Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 9, he says, I also realized the portions for the Levites had not been given them. For each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. So the Levites had to go back to work because nobody was tithing. And so God said this had to be straightened out. And of course, Nehemiah did that. He says, so I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? I gathered them together and set them in place, and all Judah brought the tithe of the grain, the new wine, and the oil to the storehouse. So he appointed people in verse 13 to organize all of these tithes that were brought in. Then he says in verse 14, remember me, O my God, concerning this. Do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services. So he claimed a blessing from God because he had been able to restore tithing into the land when God allowed him to become the governor. Now let's go to Malachi chapter 3 and verse 8. You know, the last book in the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 3 and verse 8, probably the most famous scripture on tithing. Most of us may have this memorized, or at least we've heard it enough times that we know exactly what it says. He says in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 8, again, very late in the history of Israel, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? And the answer is, in tithes and offerings. Because God claims, obviously, that the first tenth belongs to him, it is holy to him. And God says, you have robbed me by not paying the tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse. You have robbed me, even this whole nation. And certainly that's true of our nation today. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing till there not be enough room to receive it. So God promises a blessing to the tithe giver. Hebrews 6 and verse 18 says, it is impossible for God to lie. And so we know he's telling us the truth. It doesn't mean instantaneously we're all going to be wealthy because we send in one tithe check. That's not what it's talking about. But as your life progresses, God does promise to pour out blessings upon us if we are faithful tithe givers. Now, let's go back over. We talked about the transfer of the receiving of tithes from the Levites to the modern day ministry. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 9. We'll begin in verse 8. Hebrews 9, Paul is talking about the physical ordinances, the divine service of the earthly sanctuary, which was about to be passing away because the Romans were going to invade Rome or invade Jerusalem and destroy it. But he's talking about these physical things that were going on, the various censers and the offerings. In verse 8 of Hebrews chapter 9, he says, the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all, the Holy of Holies, was not made manifest while the first tabernacle was standing. In other words, nobody could go in except the high priest once a year. It was symbolic for the present time, and with both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to conscience. It concerned food, so wheat, you know, animals or food, like sheep, goats, oxen, various washings. They had to wash the bulls. The priest had to wash himself before going into the service of the tabernacle. And physical rites imposed on them until the time of Reformation, when the Israel was reformed from a physical nation into a spiritual nation, essentially. When that physical nation was gone, we have a spiritual high priest, and God is now building spiritual Israel. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation. So Christ came as a representative of good things to come. Then he mentions, of course, a little bit farther down, that the blood of bulls and goats couldn't purify it. Only Jesus Christ's blood eventually could. Now, the removal of fleshly ordinances imposed on them until the time of the Reformation just means that there is now a change that is necessary. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 7. Out of the seven changes in the Old and New Covenant, the change from a physical to a spiritual Israel is one of the most foundational. Over in Hebrews chapter 7, we'll begin in verse 5. It says, indeed, those who are the sons of Levi, who receive the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people. And we read that back in Leviticus, that God gave the tithes of the people to the Levites, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now, beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the greater, or by the better. Here, mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives. So essentially he's saying that originally the tithing was to Melchizedek, to Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ temporarily gave it to the Levites, but now it is back to Melchizedek, to the ministry that Jesus Christ has ordained, has chosen. So Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak. He was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise according to the order of Melchizedek? In other words, appointed directly by God Almighty, not because he was born of a physical father who had been a Levite. Verse 12, for the priesthood being changed, of necessity there is a change of the law. So the tithing law, the receiving of tithe, is now changed, not done away. It's simply changed as to who receives it. For he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe. In other words, to Judah. Verse 14, it is evident our Lord arose out of Judah, not from Levi. Verse 15, it is far more evident if in the likeness of Melchizedek there rises another priest. And of course, that is Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, but he has appointed and called his representatives today to be doing the work of Levites in a spiritual sense. Now, Paul also addressed this over in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Perhaps this is even more clear to understand, but both places make the same point. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, let's begin in verse 4. Here he's simply talking to a Gentile church who really didn't grow up with tithing. Now, the way Gentiles in the Greek world gave offerings, it was basically a bartering deal. They would take a goat or a sheep or whatever into the temple and say, I will give this to this idol, whether it was, you know, Dagon or Diana or something, if the priest of this idol can promise me that in return I will get good crops. Or I'll take in an offering if the priest will promise me that I will get a pretty wife, or if I will get healed of whatever disease it might be. So the Greek world had as their philosophy of offerings, it was kind of give to receive. You sort of gave to buy something. That sort of filtered over into the Roman Catholic teaching of indulgences, where you'd say so many Hail Marys, or you'd pay so much money and then get back whatever it was. And then when people would die, they would have to pay so much money, the relatives would, in order to get Uncle Harry, you know, whatever it was, prayed or seance or something from purgatory into heaven, or from the flames into purgatory, whatever it was. But the idea of giving something to an idol as an offering in exchange for whatever you've agreed to exchange it for was the background of the idolatrous system in ancient Greece and therefore in ancient Corinth. So Paul wrote to them and said, look, my defense is this, verse 3, do we have no right to eat and drink? He's talking about Paul and Barnabas. He says, do we have a right to receive tithes and offerings from the people that we serve? Do we have a right to take along a believing wife, as also do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? So the other apostles had wives they brought along with them. Barnabas and Paul did not. Is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working? Paul had to work with his own hands, he said, doing tent making in order to make a living when he went to new places. But he says, don't we have a right not to do that? Whoever goes to war at his own expense, what soldier pays his own way when he goes to war, buys his own sword and shield? Obviously none of them do. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same thing? So he's quoting a law that is still in effect. It is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is God concerned for oxen about this? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written that he who plows should plow in hope, he who threshes should thresh in hope, and be partakers of that hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? If others are partakers of this right over you, are we not more? Notice he calls it a right, not an option. Nevertheless, we have not used this right to receive tithes from them, but endure all things, lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. In the next two verses, he makes a very important point. Don't you know that those who ministered the holy things, he's talking about the Levites, they ministered the holy things of the temple, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar. So he's talking about the system God set up for the Levites to receive tithes from the land, from the people that brought their offerings and their tithes to the temple. Even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. Now the Greek word even so, the English translation is strong enough, but a better translation is in the same manner or according to the same system. So it's really showing that the system of tithing has now been transferred from the Levites who minister at the physical temple to those who are now preaching the gospel should partake of that system. Verse 15, but I have used none of these things, nor have I written these things that it should not be done for me. In other words, I could have used the authority to receive tithes from you, but I didn't because of your background and your weakness of understanding. But the important thing to realize in these two verses is the unequivocal statement about the transferring, that God has now used this same system to provide for those who are preaching the gospel. Now let's end today over in Matthew 23:23, probably the second most well-known or memorized scripture concerning tithing. Jesus Christ very plainly talked about tithing. Those who would say he didn't have simply not read the scripture or have read it and not understood it. But in Matthew 23 and verse 23, as he is talking to the scribes and Pharisees right before he was arrested later that same week, he says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, little tiny leaves, little tiny seeds they would count out to make sure they had exactly one-tenth and no more. You have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith, the really meaty matters of how you treat people, how you administer my laws. You've neglected those. He says, these you ought to have done, but without leaving the others undone. He said, look, even the little matters of tithing aren't important. You ought to leave that undone, but it's very important that you see the big picture, the weightier matters of the law, which are justice and mercy and faith. And of course, God promises us to bless us in all ways if we keep each one of his laws, the little ones and the big ones, because he sees what we do in secret and promises to reward us openly.